From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Larry Tye is my guest this week. His latest book, Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend, is not only a biography of the baseball great Satchel Paige, but a portrait of a time in America that now seems like another world. Larry Tye, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Good to be with you.
One of your previous books was a portrait of Pullman Porters, the Georges of the American Rail. Why are you drawn to that particular aspect of America's past, the time when African Americans were second-class citizens and to whom the idea of a black president was unthinkable?
Because I agree with Bill Clinton that race remains the story of America, and that these two pieces of that racial story, the Pullman Porters and Satchel Paige, are American stories that I think haven't been told before and that are, to me, the all-American success story. The idea that African-American men who were just freed as slaves could go on to get jobs on the railroad and watch their children and grandchildren become the great American lawyers and doctors and politicians and help form the basis of the black middle class, to me, was an irresistible story. And it was the Pullman Porters who first pointed me to the story of the favorite of all the black passengers that they carried over their 100 years in the railroad, and that was the great Negro League ballplayer Satchel Paige. And they said that he was the embodiment of the all-American success story, and I think he was. He was, again, a guy who grew up in Jim Crow segregated America in Mobile, Alabama, one of 12 children, and went on to become not just the greatest pitcher arguably in the history of baseball, but a leader in a quiet leader in the civil rights movement in America before we knew there was such a thing as a civil rights movement in America.
Well, and you paint a very vivid picture of the era, you know, so well. And were you more interested in baseball or social history with this book?
Well, the wonderful thing about the Satchel Paige story is that if you just tell the story of Satchel Paige, his life as a ball player and as a human being, you are basically writing a biography of Satchel Paige and of Jim Crow at the same time, because his life so closely mirrored the history of this segregation movement in America. He was born at the very moment that the South was passing its Jim Crow laws separating blacks and whites in everything from schools to public transportation to, in the case of Satchel Paige in his later life, the baseball world. And his whole life was a piece of that progression of segregation all the way through to the time when we started throwing away these segregated institutions.
It's pretty remarkable that he ever played in the major leagues, given the year that he was born. But although that's kind of in dispute, why is his age such a... You do seem to unravel it all in your book, but why is his age such an issue?
Well, that's a good question, and the fact is, I thought it would be a simple question of looking at his official government records. So I pulled Satchel Paige's Social Security file, his draft record, and his passport file, and they all shared three things. One is that they were all supplied by Satchel Paige. The second is that they were all lies. And the third is that they all, I think, masked the same truth about Satchel. And that truth is that he wasn't content to let the press fan his legend. He knew that most of the prime of his baseball life, when he was playing in the segregated Negro leagues, there were no reporters out there following his exploits and writing about his no-hitters and his shutouts. And so he felt that he had to create his own legend. And as part of that, he took what he thought was a harmless matter like the date that he was born. And when America wanted a startlingly young ball player, Satchel became as young as Peter Pan. When how old he was became an even better story, he was as old as Methuselah. And the truth was sitting there in the Mobile County, Alabama, health department all the time, his actual birth certificate, which showed that he was born on July 7th, 1906. And that's a date that, in a way, that Satchel would love if he knew. It's a date that the American Library of Congress calls on that day. Every day The Library of Congress has on its website something that was the most important thing that ever happened in history on that day. And for July 7th, 1906, the first event that they say was the singly most important in American history was the birth of Satchel Paige.
Well, that really is amazing. So tell us a little bit about his youth.
Sure. He grew up in Mobile, and he grew up at the very moment that Mobile was going from being one of the more tolerant of the Deep South cities when it came to race relations to having its own series of lynchings. He grew up with a mother who was a washerwoman, a father who liked to call himself a landscaper, but was in fact an occasionally employed gardener, and with 11 brothers and sisters. And what that meant was, as soon as he was old enough to go out and do anything, he had to go out. He started out collecting old bottles that he could find in alleys that he could turn in for a penny a bottle and help put some money on the table and some food on the table. He later went out when he was 8 and 9 and 10 years old to the local L&N train station, and he carried people's bags for a dime a bag the way a red cap would. And that was actually how he says he got his name, Satchel, that he learned how to carry with a set of ropes and pulleys 3 or 4 bags at once where he could earn 30 and 40 cents at the same time. And a buddy saw him pulling along this series of suitcases and said, "You look like a walking satchel tree." And Satchel said that's how the name Satchel stuck with him. As with everything with Satchel, though, there was never a single version. And a buddy of his named Wilbur Hines tells the story that it was not because he was carrying people's bags, but it was because he was stealing them that he, Wilbur, dubbed him Satchel.
So everybody claimed to give him that. Someone else claims to have given him the name also, right?
Yeah, lots of people. His sister say that he was named Satchel because he used to take his dad's old satchel bag down to the ballpark and carry away old balls and broken bats. Everybody had a different version. The wonderful thing is that the name did stick, and today, even with people who aren't quite sure what his story is, you say the name Satchel, and people say, "Oh yes, Satchel Paige." And Spike Lee was impressed enough with what Satchel Paige did that he named his daughter Satchel. Another movie maker, hold 1 second.
Mm-hmm.
Woody Allen.
Oh right.
Loved Satchel Paige enough that he named his son Satchel, and one of the great old Boston Celtics ball players in the era when the Celtics ran up 13 world championships, Tom Sanders, was a young black guy who was looking around for a role model, and even though he was playing basketball, he was so impressed the biggest black role model when he was growing up in terms of athletes was Satchel Paige, and so Sanders became Tom Satch Sanders, and one of the nicest tributes you can give to somebody is naming people or naming yourself after a guy, and all kinds of famous people did it after Satchel.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Larry Tye, and his latest book is called Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend. How do you think Satchel Paige would stack up with today's Major League ballplayer?
Well, I think that your listeners are probably much more savvy than I am in terms of getting into the ins and outs of who was the best. What I can say for sure is two things. One is that he ranks with the best pitchers of all times. He threw the baseball so hard that his catchers had to cushion their gloves with beefsteaks so that their hands wouldn't be burning at the end of the game. And he learned how to throw with such accuracy that his teammates would stand there with lit cigarettes in their mouth, letting him throw a hard ball towards their face at 90 miles or more an hour, and they had the faith that he would hit the cigarette and not their head.
Was there drinking involved in this?
There was not drinking. My guess is that hopefully Satchel wasn't drinking, but his teammates must have been to have let him do this. But he ranked with the greatest pitchers of all times in terms of both speed and accuracy, and I'm talking about everybody from Christy Mathewson and Cy Young to, in more modern times, Roger Clemens and Sandy Koufax and Pedro Martinez. But the one thing that he had over all of those guys, and this is the one thing that I can say definitively, is that no pitcher in the history of baseball ever threw at a high level for longer than Satchel Paige. He was out there starting his professional career in 1926. He pitched his last major league ball game in 1965, and he went on pitching until the early 1970s. So for more than 40 years, he was out there throwing a baseball and throwing it well, and nobody in the history of baseball has ever done it for longer.
You're saying that he threw a ball professionally in his 60s?
I'm saying he threw a ball professionally in his 60s. I'm saying that he threw his last major league, he tossed his last major league game, three innings for the Kansas City A's against the Boston Red Sox. Three shutout innings at age 59 years, 2 months, and 8 days. And that set a record in the major leagues that will never be broken. We think it's a medical miracle when Roger Clemens can come back and throw at age 45, and Satchel Paige was doing it at high level at 59.
Well, Satchel Paige didn't even, the major leagues weren't open to him until he was 45 or something, right?
Until he actually signed his first major league contract on his 42nd birthday, and so it was extraordinary. He pitched a year after Branch Rickey broke the color barrier in baseball by signing Jackie Robinson to pitch for the Brooklyn Dodgers. A year after Jackie was called up to the Dodgers, Satchel was signed that summer by a crazy owner named Bill Veeck of the Cleveland Indians. And as I say, he signed his contract on his 42nd birthday, and he went on at age 42 to pitch to a 6-1 record to help take the Indians to the World Series, to score the second lowest earned run average in the American League. And most impressively, at age 42, he was named by 12 Associated Press sports writers as the Rookie of the Year. And Satchel's response was wonderful. He said, "I'm delighted, but I'm not quite sure what year the gentleman's was talking about."
Well, you do a wonderful job in the book of painting a picture of the old Negro leagues, of which Satchel Paige was such a part of. And I'm sort of curious to know the ins and outs of that league, because apparently he could switch teams back and forth and all that. Tell us a little bit about the Negro leagues.
Sure. Before they had such a thing as free agency, Satchel Paige was a free agent. He was so good that he would sign a contract and break the contract, and the same owner who he had walked out on would bring him back because Satchel could fill the ballpark and fill the owner's pockets with money. And he was doing all this in the Negro Leagues, which were this segregated world that was set up in the early 1900s. In the late 1800s, after the Civil War, baseball, in fact, was integrated at very high levels. And whites and blacks were not only playing in the same field, they were playing on the same team. And it was only when the Jim Crow laws came into effect, about 35 years after the end of the Civil War, that America started resegregating itself. And one of the places it did it was in baseball. Blacks were barred from the major leagues, and so they formed their own parallel universe. It was like a shadow league. And the good news was that there were great ball players there, and that on a Sunday afternoon in particular, it was the centerpiece of black society. You'd have everybody from Pullman porters to janitors and farmers, and anybody who could afford to buy a baseball ticket would be out there and want to see the ball game and want to be seen by everybody else. Women would put on their best mink stoles and high heels. Men would don straw hats, and they'd be out there. Church would be let out early, not just so congregants would make it in time to the big ball game, but so the ministers would. And what everybody really wanted to see was the pitching duel of the week, which always featured on the teams that he played on, Satchel Paige. And the good news was that this was about as high as you could make it in the black world financially and in terms of social status back then. The bad news was, unlike the major leagues, the Negro leagues were always financially precarious. They never had the press coverage that the majors did. Even black newspapers couldn't afford to send out reporters to all the games. And so a lot of these black ball players, like Satchel Paige and the great slugging Josh Gibson, knew that they were every bit as good, if not better, than 90% of the major leaguers, and yet they were relegated to this shadow universe. And while guys like Babe Ruth and Joe DiMaggio took off for Broadway, Satchel was left in Outer Mongolia playing to much too small crowds in second-rate ballparks often, and earning, everybody but Satchel Paige, earned only a fraction of what the major leaguers did.
But he did pretty well financially.
He did. And by the late 1930s, Satchel was making $40,000 a year, which, to put it into context, was four times what the average New York Yankee was making and twice what the great batting champion Ted Williams was making. On the other hand, while those major leaguers played baseball from April to October, Satchel, to earn his money, played from April to April. He'd play in Negro leagues. He'd barnstorm in small towns across America with any local team that could pay money to bring him to town. And in the cold weather, he would head to California for the winter league play there, and then he'd go down south to Puerto Rico, to Cuba, to the Dominican Republic, to Venezuela, to anywhere that he could find a baseball game. He was pitching all year round, so he earned his money, but he also made a lot of money.
Where did the Negro Leagues play? What kinds of stadiums did they play in?
Well, in the early days, they played in second-rate stadiums, and they played in ballparks that fit a fraction of the number of fans that the Major League stadiums did. But in later years, in the 30s and into the 40s, they started renting out Major League stadiums when the Major League teams were on the road. And so whether you were the Brooklyn Dodgers or the Chicago White Sox, the owners had yet another incentive to keep Major Leagues segregated. They did it because they or their fans were racist. They did it because that's what America was like back then, and they did it maybe most of all because they were making this extra cash by having these Negro Leaguers there who would rent out their otherwise empty stadiums every time they were traveling somewhere else.
We're speaking with Larry Tye, author of Rising from the Rails, Pullman Porters and the Making of the Black Middle Class, in his new book, Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend. The opening of the color barrier of the major leagues kind of killed the Negro Leagues then. I mean, there must have only been a fraction of the Negro League players who got to play in the National League or American League. What happened to the rest of them?
Yeah, let me tell you, there are two stories in terms of what happened with Negro Leaguers when baseball started to integrate. The first was the story of the people, either because they were too old or because they just weren't good enough, all the players who didn't make it. And that was, as you say, the majority. It was probably 80 to 90% of the ball players. And those guys eventually, not too many years after Jackie Robinson integrated, the teams just couldn't continue to support. The black fans were going to watch black ball players in major league stadiums. The best of the black ball players were gone off to the major leagues. And the Negro League teams, one by one, went out of business. And so those ball players who had depended on the Negro Leagues for their livelihood were out of business and had to go try to do something else. The ones who made the transition, the ones who were lucky enough, like Jackie Robinson and Satchel Paige, they generally did well. They were the best of the Negro Leaguers. As long as they were still had some energy in them, they were able to go out and show their stuff like Satchel did and certainly like Jackie Robinson did. And very quickly, lots of them became most valuable players for their leagues. They helped lead their teams the way that Satchel did to World Series wins, and they did well, but it was very sad. The Branch Rickey never paid the owner of the Kansas City Monarchs, where he stole Jackie Robinson. He never paid him a penny. Bill Veeck, who was much more generous and much more willing to acknowledge what they were doing in killing the Negro Leagues, when Bill Veeck signed Satchel, he also gave some money to J.L. Wilkinson, the owner of the Kansas City Monarchs. But it was like what was going on in the schools and everywhere else. There were these great institutions that had formed in this segregated world, the all-black schools with all their African-American teachers, and those institutions crumbled when integration came in. Integration was a good thing, and just about everybody in the black world wanted the chance to operate in an integrated world, but it also, it was in that transition period very, very painful for people who had been in that all-black universe.
So you mentioned that Satchel Paige was in some way a civil rights activist or responsible for the breaking down of segregated America. Can you amplify that a little bit?
Sure. Satchel Paige was, on the one hand, nobody knew that there was such a thing as a civil rights movement back in the 20s and 30s and even the early 40s. And so Satchel Paige was never self-conscious about what he was doing in terms of pushing for racial equality, but he did it. He did it in subtle ways like saying, if you want my team to come to your town and play your local team in a barnstorming pickup game, you've got to guarantee them a place to eat and a place to sleep. And in a lot of those towns where there were only whites and where everything was segregated, the idea of letting in a black to their restaurant or to their hotel was something that they had never imagined doing. And Satchel said, that's the only way I'll come, and cities generally oblige and figure out a place to do that. And that may not seem especially radical to us today, but it was radical enough back then that the FBI opened up a file on Satchel Paige. He was the one who brought the attention of the white press and eventually of white America to just how good a lot of ball players were in the Negro Leagues, to particularly his all-black Kansas City Monarchs, which was at that time the best team in the Negro Leagues, and to a second-string second baseman on the Monarchs named Jackie Robinson. The only reason Branch Rickey knew about Jackie Robinson when he signed him to the Brooklyn Dodgers was because Jackie was playing on Satchel's team. And so Satchel was out there a generation before the world knew about Jackie Robinson, making the case for black ball players and for integration. And in the words of an old Negro leaguer who said it much more eloquently than I can, Jackie Robinson was the one who opened the door to the new racial reality in baseball, but it was Satchel Paige who inserted the key.
I want to ask you about his pitching. What did his pitching look like?
His pitching was extraordinary. He kicked his leg so high up in the air that it looked like it would black out the sky. When he extended his long right arm forward to throw the baseball, by the time he let go of the ball, it looked like it was in the batter's face, that his hand was in the batter's face. He had that kind of a reach. He could throw in his later years with no windup at all or with a triple windmill windup. He could throw underhanded, sidearm, and overhand. He threw a curveball that had such a bend in it that Joe DiMaggio said it gave him optical indigestion. He learned how to throw a knuckleball. He was extraordinary. In the early days, he basically threw a fastball and a faster ball, and in his later years, he had a variety of pitches that was what let him extend the life of his arm and extend his pitching career into the years when most ball players were watching from the bleachers with big bear bellies, and Satchel was still out there throwing a ball and earning a living.
Did he ever throw a perfect game or a no-hitter?
Well, he says he threw 50 no-hitters, and we have records of him having thrown a series of no-hitters. Whether he actually did 50, who knows? But if he did 50, that would, by more than a factor of 10, break the major league record. He said he threw 200 shutouts. He said he pitched 2,500 games and won 2,000 of them. And when I looked at most of these records, to the extent that we could tell, it looks like he really did pitch 2,500 games. He was pitching just about every night, two or three innings, all year round for 40 to 50 years. And 2,500, when you look at that kind of longevity, doesn't look so extraordinary.
No perfect game on record.
No perfect game that we know about, and yet if you did 50 no-hitters, if he did what he had claimed, my guess is it was a perfect game in there somewhere. The difficulty with him is partly that the records weren't there because he was pitching a lot of his games in the Negro Leagues where there were no really good records kept, and more importantly, he was pitching on this barnstorming circuit. And it was tough to measure. Sometimes he was pitching against extraordinary major league opponents when he compiled these brilliant records, and other times he was pitching against a bunch of farmers who raised money in a small town in Iowa to bring in Satchel Paige and his all-stars, and that's not really fair. I mean, pitching a perfect game against them would be like doing it against, you know, 15-year-olds. And so what we can say definitively is that when he was stacked up against the best that white baseball had to offer, he always came through. But as he would be the first one to tell us if he were here telling the stories today, a lot of his opponents in those early years when he was trying to make a living any way he could were truly third or fourth rate.
He was frequently late to the ballpark.
Satchel did anything that it took to get where he was going. He drove extraordinarily fast. Most of the teammates who ever traveled with him never wanted to do it any more than they had to because they felt they were taking their life in their hands. And he would get stopped for speeding, and if the officer told him that it was a $25 fine, he'd hand him $50, and he'd say, "I'm going to be coming back the same way next week." With his driving, as with everything else, it was partly Satchel the showman, but it was also Satchel with this natural sense of humor and charisma. And because of who he was, even white police officers would let him get away with extraordinary things because everybody had heard of Satchel Paige.
Well, the book is called Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend, and the author is Larry Tye. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf this week.
It was great to be with you. Thank you for letting me tell some stories.
That closes the book on this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program. I'll be back again next week with another great show. In the meantime, you can check us out on Facebook or iTunes or our podcast page at KUSP.org. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, Miss Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. And I want to thank Larry Tye for being my guest this week. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.